You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
People who have been to North Korea say it feels frozen in time. There are only a few cars on the road, there's little electricity, and a crumbling infrastructure. A famine in the 1990s killed as many as 2 million people, or a tenth of the population, and the hunger continues today. But specific details of what's happening inside the country are virtually impossible to get, thanks to a brutal regime that keeps its people totally isolated from the rest of the world. In Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea, Barbara Demick, the Beijing bureau chief for the LA Times, shines a light on the suffering and oppression through the eyes of six people who managed to escape. And I'm very pleased to welcome you back to our show.
Thanks so much.
What do North Korean cities and towns look like?
They look dark, basically. Dark and bleak and colorless. North Korea is, a country somewhat frozen in time, as you mentioned, to the extent that there's cars. They look like they come from the 1970s. The buildings were mostly...
Are they all built by North Korea?
Most of it was built by North Korea. I mean, North Korea was completely flattened in the Korean War, 1950 to 53. And so most of it was built in the 60s, 70s, to some extent the 80s. You know, after that, in the 90s, the country went into a free fall economically, so everything stopped. So it definitely has that frozen in time, from people's fashions to the cars to even the color palette.
Is Pyongyang, the capital, an exception because it's where outsiders are most likely to visit?
Pyongyang is, it's very tidy. It's well organized. There's not much traffic, but it still has that weird retro feel. They built a pyramid-shaped hotel that was supposed to be the tallest building in Asia, and it stopped in the late 1980s, so it sort of looms there on the skyline. Now, they just started renovating it again in the last 2 years, and they're trying to redo the facade. But it still has that stopped-in-time feel, and it is very, very quiet. I kind of like it because I live in Asia now. I live in Beijing, and there's no traffic, there's no pollution. You open your window, and you can hear, as they say, a baby crying from across the street. It's very quiet.
Whereas in Beijing, you have a booming economy, a lot of cars out the road actually pushing the bicyclists to the side.
That's right. That's right. I've been among those pushed. So, yeah, it's... In North Korea, it's very retro, and it's funny when you even see the people. The women's lipstick is some strange color, and the hairstyles are from the past, and it's changing. They're getting some fashion, some products in from China, but it's not changing very fast. So it's a strange experience.
Well, as we said, electricity is limited, but would that be the case in Pyongyang as well?
It is the case in Pyongyang, and if there's a special event, for example, I was there in 2008 with the New York Philharmonic, and it was all lit up. They had sort of Christmas lights on Kim Il Sung Square, and our hotel was well heated and well lit. But I knew people who lived in Pyongyang at the time, and they said as soon as the delegation left, it was pitch dark again.
And why? Don't they have electrical power plants?
Their whole electrical infrastructure has crumbled long ago. I mean, they don't have the fuel oil, they don't have the power, but the whole system has broken down. And what's strange about North Korea, unlike a real third world country that was never electrified, is North Korea was in the 1970s pretty well developed. It was not maybe until the mid-70s, it was better. The economy was stronger than South Korea.
And before, the Japanese had built, made into an industrial might, didn't it? They put most of their industry.
Well, it was it was a colony, and they developed the mining and some of the factories. I don't know that they really made that much of a lasting contribution. But, certainly the North Koreans, and this is something, one forgets, from the end of the Korean War, 1953, through the 60s and maybe some point in the 70s, that North Koreans seemed to be doing better than the South Koreans. And, you know, North Korea was more like Yugoslavia. It wasn't a laughing stock. So this is a country that's kind of fallen out of the modern world. It's not a country that never was there. And that makes things a bit more painful for people.
And that's all because of ideology? Or are there other factors?
It's, you know, it's the failed socialist economy. The North Korea was developed with a lot of help from the Soviet bloc, from the Chinese. The North Koreans were, and actually still are, very adept at extracting aid from their neighbors. And, you know, it was a system that couldn't sustain itself. People blame the collapse of the Soviet Union for triggering this economic freefall, but the whole place was falling apart.
On the other hand, it's a country that's capable of building sophisticated missiles, atomic weapons. So is all of the genius of the country focused in those areas?
Exactly. You know, it's always astonishing to any of us who visited North Korea to think about them having a sophisticated weapons program, because if you look at a North Korean pencil or a piece of paper, you know, it will crumble in your hands. You know, the lead will fall out of the pencil. I mean, they can't make a pair of shoes, you know, yet they're making, you know, atomic weapons.
So what is a typical home? What does a typical home look like? Do they have appliances of any sophistication? Well, if they don't have electricity, does it really matter if they have appliances?
It does not matter. I mean, I'll tell you more about...
They have TV? They have radio?
If you're wealthy, you have a TV and radio. I mean, I'll tell you about a typical home in Shenzhen. Now, I would say I've been to Pyongyang 3 times. I have not been in a typical home. If you're allowed in somebody's home, it's a showcase home. But when I was working on this book, I walked 3 people through, you know, what does your home look like? And it was always very funny to me. I'm glad you asked this question, because they would always say, well, it's just like a typical North Korean home. And I would say, yeah, I grew up in a typical New Jersey suburb. You know, what did I have in my house? The main characters in my book grew up in what was called a harmonica house. And this is a harmonica because it's chambers, and there might be 5 single rooms that are attached. And on one side, there's entrances, and you walk in, and there's a sort of a kitchen space that's a bit lower. In traditional Korean homes, the heating is underneath, and the stove is built into the floor. And then in the back, there'd be a single room with maybe yellow vinyl on the floor, an empty wall, empty except for the portraits of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. North Koreans are required to have the 2 portraits on their wall. They're not allowed to have anything else on the wall, no family photos, no, you know, doodads, no embroidery.
And do people come and check that out?
They do come and check that out. They come and inspect pretty regularly. And the North Koreans also have a special cloth that goes in its own box, and you're supposed to dust the portraits. And it's funny, you know, when I've been in Pyongyang, I like to walk around at night so I can peek in people's windows if they have electricity. And you can see in the apartment blocks, you know, the rows of portraits. And then other stuff, I mean, that the North Koreans will judge themselves by how many appliances they have. I mean, people who are wealthy will have a TV or a radio. Those are usually, you know, given to you by your workplace. You can't just go out and buy them. But traditionally, if you had a certain kind of job, you could get them. And the regime did make them available because TV and radio are, you know, the main propaganda instruments.
But they can black out TV and radio from nearby neighbors, South Korea,
yes.
Japan,
China. Your television is fixed to the government channel. The radio is fixed to the government channel. There's an electrical wave inspection bureau that will come and inspect. Now, one of the people in my book, sort of a young intellectual who was a university student in Pyongyang, he went and bought himself a Japanese TV on the black market, and he was a little fairly clever. And he, you know, put the antenna so that he could get South Korean broadcasts. And people do that, and they do that with radio. But it was very dangerous, and he would have gone to prison camp if he had been caught.
My guest is Barbara Demick. Her book, Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea, is published by Spiegel and Grau. So there is a black market there. Does the government allow the black market to exist?
Grudgingly. When the famine got really bad in the 1990s, they sort of belatedly legalized the markets, and they allowed people to sell, more and more goods. You used to only be able to buy homegrown vegetables at the market. And then the markets began getting, produce from China, manufactured goods, shampoos, shoes, sodas, cookies. And, it changes every few months. But Kim Jong-il, the current leader of North Korea, has really tried to turn back the clock. And, there are constant efforts to close the markets or restrict them. They've the law bans younger women and men from working at the market. Women have to be in some places 40 or some places 50.
And what's the reasoning behind that?
That the most useful part of the population has to work in the state-owned enterprises, which you may not be getting a paycheck there, and the state-owned enterprise may not be producing anything. You have to report to your job.
You're saying people go to jobs and then don't do any work?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. This woman in my book, Mrs. Song, who was like a real true believer, talked about how she would go to this factory she went to. She worked in a clothing factory, and they had no electricity. They had no fabric. They had no thread. But she would still have to show up every day. She would have to stay. Sometimes she would sleep. Then she would, attend the propaganda lectures. Sometimes they would clean the factory, but they weren't doing any work and they weren't getting paid. But this was, this was required. And in fact, you could go to a detention camp for shirking your work duty. But people always try to get out of their jobs because they're not getting money. So they try to work on the market, but they haven't. They really haven't, opened up very much. The market activity is still very, very restricted.
But you describe her as a true believer. So despite all of the hardships, she still believes that Kim Jong-il is a great leader, a brilliant leader?
She believed until the very end. I mean, she saw her paycheck stopped, her food distribution stopped. Her family was living in a city with absolutely no food. Her mother-in-law died. Her husband died. She lost her only son. And, through the end, she thought it was her fault that she had failed and not that the government failed. And, I mean, this, shows the overpowering propaganda.
And I want to get to the propaganda in a moment, but I'm curious about who is favored and why. There still is, even though this is supposed to be a class of society, some people do live better than others, don't they?
Yeah, of course they do. And people are rated based on their loyalty to the regime. I mean, this is kind of like the Cultural Revolution in China, except it never ended and it still persists to this day. There's a core class, but at the very top is Kim Jong-il, his relatives, the country's leaders, the top people in the military, all members of the Workers' Party. The Workers' Party is their communist party. Then you go down to what's called the hostile class, and this is families who have relatives in South Korea, like the young woman who's kind of the heroine of my book. Her father was from South Korea. He had fought in the Korean War as a South Korean soldier, was taken prisoner of war, and then eventually assimilated into North Korean society.
So they were always held in suspicion.
Yeah, and contempt, and they were, members of the lowest class, Christians, anybody who was, suspect for some reason. And then there's a big wavering class in the middle, but you are ranked. People have a good sense of where they rank, and your opportunities in life are limited by what your class is. It's very Confucian.
My guest is Barbara Demick, who is the Beijing Bureau Chief of the Los Angeles Times. Her reporting on North Korea won the Overseas Press Club's Award for Human Rights Reporting, as well as awards from the Asia Society and the American Academy of Diplomacy. Her book, Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea, it's published by Spiegel and Grau, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Barbara Demick of the Los Angeles Times. Her book, Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea, is published by Spiegel and Grau. Why this title, Nothing to Envy?
Nothing to Envy comes from a very famous North Korean song, We Have Nothing to Envy in the World. And this is kind of the favorite song of North Korean kindergartners. In fact, some of the kindergartens have this slogan, we have nothing to envy in this world. And the song goes on, we have nothing to envy in this world. We live, you know, under the protection of our father, Kim Il-sung. Now it's Kim Jong-il. And this is what people are taught to believe. We have nothing to envy. We are happy. That's the propaganda.
And is this something that begins with kindergarten, or does a kid entering kindergarten already know an awful lot about what the propaganda wants them to think?
Already. I mean, it starts from the moment they can speak. The children, you know, children don't have birthday parties in North Korea. They celebrate the birthday of Kim Il-sung and the birthday of Kim Jong-il. They get candies for the leaders' birthdays. You know, people have told me, you know, how cute it was when their children were two, that they could start, you know, saying, you know, thank you, leader Kim Il-sung. This is, you know, the first thing they say. They say their thanks to the portraits in their house. So, you know, it is literally cradle to grave. Also, many children go to daycare because the women work. And, you know, go ahead.
Are they so cut off that they really believe they have nothing to envy? Some of them have relatives who live outside of North Korea. The black market, I'm sure, brings in other things as well. Are they so totally subject to the propaganda machine?
They are that totally cut off. Less in the last few years, but I think there are still many people who believe they have nothing to envy. And this is part of the reason North Korea is so hermetically sealed. It is certainly the most closed country in the world. No internet, no foreign media. You can't make a telephone call into North Korea. They just, you know, got mobile telephones in parts of Pyongyang, but you can't call out. So they have people who have relatives on the outside have very little contact with them. There are some exceptions in the last few years that I can talk about. But this complete control of the media is the core of the North Korean system. And this is something I really try to explain because people don't, you know, Americans don't understand, you know, how North Koreans can believe this garbage. Like, how can these people be so crazy as to believe it? But, you know, if you imagine, you know, this is, even in the United States, if all of our media, if, you know, the networks, CNN, Fox, NPR, the Leonard Lopate Show were all taken over by some, you know, bizarre cult that was, you know, telling people that Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il were God. People would believe that. You have no, you know, competing voices.
So what led the people you spoke to defect?
Little coincidences, little strange things in their lives. What I liked about these people is that they were, you know, I hate to say ordinary, but they were typical in some way. None of them were really dissidents. One image, anything that punctures the illusion will corrupt your sense that you have nothing to envy. There was one guy, you know, I love this story, and because you're a radio broadcaster, maybe you could appreciate it. This guy was a member of the fisheries division in a town called Sinuiju, and, you know, a party member, very loyal. And one day they captured a Chinese fishing boat that had been fishing illegally, and they turned on the radio and they picked up a broadcast from South Korea, and it was a radio comedy about two young women who were having a fight about a parking space. And the guy listened to this. He was, you know, he was a middle-aged party member. He didn't know anybody who owned a car. Nobody owns a car. And he thought, is this a satire or a parody? How could, you know, how could young women, you know, be fighting about a parking space? And over, you know, he only heard this broadcast for a few minutes, but over a period of months afterwards, he realized that, in fact, there were so many cars in South Korea that people fought over parking spaces. And he defected about 2 years later. Now, this was not long ago. This was, I think he heard this broadcast around 2000 and defected maybe 2003, 2004.
How do you get out? Most of them go into China, but China has been rather hostile to defectors, hasn't it?
Yeah, this guy was a very unusual story. Because he was in the fishing business, he took a boat and came through the Yellow Sea. This is very unusual. Almost all the defectors come out through the Chinese-North Korean border. It runs more than 800 miles. There's a section in the far north around the Tumen River where the river is no wider than this room, and we're in quite a small room. And in the winter, you can walk over the ice. In the fall, you can wade through. And that's how they get into China. Now, once they get there, if they're caught by the Chinese, they'll be sent back, and they're in, you know, bigger trouble than they were to begin with. But
and then they have to establish a life in China, which is difficult because many of them really don't have skills that the Chinese would require. If they try to go to South Korea, it means making a huge trip through China to get to a place where they can actually go into South Korea.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult for them to get from China to South Korea. And the South Koreans, I mean, this gets into a whole other subject, but, you know, South Korea considers itself the rightful government of the entire Korean peninsula. So in theory, all North Koreans are entitled to citizenship, but they have to get there, and they don't make it easy for them to get there. This is a whole other issue.
Now, one of the defectors in your book is a doctor. Was she better off than other people?
Only marginally. And in fact, you know, at the end, she wasn't better off. She was, again, the daughter of a party member, very loyal, very idealistic. When the system was still functioning, she, you know, had a slightly better salary than others. But very early in her career, she got out of medical school around 1990. Very early in her career, the salaries were cut off. The medicine was cut off. She told me harrowing stories about...
So she couldn't really practice medicine?
No. I mean, she told me the stories about the hospitals, and I know that this is still the case in North Korean hospitals. I mean, they if you wanted to get an IV, you had to bring in your own bottles, usually beer bottles.
Wow.
And one of my chapters is called, you know, two beer bottles for your IV.
Well, how much training did she get? If the schools are largely for propaganda, do they actually learn about modern science? Would she know as much about medicine as a doctor in a third world country might know going through a medical school?
I think not, because, you know, their isolation applies to academics as well. It's very difficult to train doctors who don't have access to the internet, who don't have access to current textbooks. You know, there are various NGOs that are, you know, trying to bring up the standard of the doctors. And, you know, on the one hand, I think that many of their doctors are very committed and very hardworking. These are smart, sincere people, but they don't have, you know, their standards have lowered over time because they're cut off from the world. And this is North Korea's essential dilemma. How can they modernize without globalizing?
My guest is Barbara Demick, whose book, Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea, is published by Spiegel & Grau. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You include a love story in this book. Couples on a date can't exactly go out to dinner and a movie, so how do they court each other?
Well, this couple had one bit of good fortune and a few pieces of very bad luck, but it was their bad luck that they came from different class backgrounds. The girl, as I mentioned, was the daughter of a South Korean soldier, so she was in among the lowest classes. and her boyfriend came from a higher class and was an aspiring university student scientist. And they really could not be seen together because that would have really hurt his career. But their good luck was that the time that they fell for each other, there was no more electricity. So they would go out, you know, after dark when nobody could see them. And, you know, when it's dark in North Korea, it's really dark. I mean, this is like being in the desert. You can't even tell that you're in the middle of a city because, you know, there's no light in the windows. It's dark. And, you know, they would go walking in the dark. I think people go to parks, they walk around. At the point their relationship was taking place, the movie theaters were closed, the restaurants were closed, the stores were closed. For a long time, he was in university in Pyongyang, she was back in Chongjin, the city that I'm writing about, and there was no mail service, there was no telephone.
There aren't arranged marriages. People still have to find each other.
There are many arranged marriages, but, you know, like other...
Even in a communist system?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. North Korea is very Confucian, and most of the, in fact, all of the older people I've met, the North Koreans, were in arranged marriages. Now, young people, you know, are less likely to be fixed up.
As you point out, they're constantly watched for behavior that could be considered disloyal to the government. What kinds of things get you into trouble?
Well,
other than going out with somebody of a different class?
Well, one guy in my book, the husband of this very loyal factory worker, was watching a TV program about galoshes. It was just a business report about some factory that was producing, you know, we're producing, you know, thousands of galoshes to keep people's feet dry. And he sort of said out loud, if there's so many galoshes, how come my kids don't have any? And he was reported and called in by the national security to explain the remark. And he was actually of a fairly high class and well-connected. Had he been of a lower class, he could have been taken away for life. People who've said things more critical of Kim Il-sung or Kim Jong-il are taken away. You know, it's a crime to put your cup of coffee on a picture of a cup of tea, say, since this is North Korea, but put, you know, a liquid on a picture of Kim Jong-il, and all the newspapers have the photographs.
Well, how did the government propaganda machine explain the widespread starvation during the famine of the 90s?
Oh, well, that's easy. You know, the imperialist Americans have, you know, blockaded our food. We're stockpiling food to feed the hungry masses in South Korea for the blessed day of unification. You know, many, many explanations. They began to call the famine the Arduous March, which referred to a World War II military campaign supposedly led by Kim Il-sung. And, you know, in the spirit of the Arduous March, you had to endure these hard times. And people who lost family members and were starving, they felt it was they who failed.
Because in other places where there have been these sorts of things, people eventually have gotten together and rebelled. And we've seen, for other reasons, but we've seen the fall of Stalinism, of Maoism, the Stasi, you know, no matter how much control they had and how much control they had over people's lives, East Germany fell. Is there any possibility that there would be any kind of organized opposition here?
You know, it's funny. During the 1990s, it was a matter of faith, virtual certainty among all the North Korea experts that the country was on the verge of collapse. And, you know, it hasn't happened so far. I think one reason that it hasn't is that the control is so absolute that people, you know, can't conspire. I mean, Kim Jong-il has spent most of his time in power. He took over from his father in 1994, consolidating power, making sure the generals are loyal, and the members of the nomenklatura, I don't know what they call them in North Korea, are, I think, certainly aware of the situation in China. I think they're aware that their economy is a basket case. But I think they realize that if they begin to reform, it will it's likely to collapse once there's any kind of outside influences. And, you know, they're also, people are afraid to do anything, not just for themselves, but North Korea has this very Confucian system of punishment. They punished through the third degree of blood relations. If you do something wrong, three generations of your relatives, three degrees removed, will be punished. And in fact, one of the people in the book, this young woman, Moran, said to me, you know, if you had one life to live to get rid of this horrible regime, you would do so. But, you know, are you willing to make that decision for your parents, for your nieces and nephews?
A listener asked about North Korea's recent currency devaluation. Are you...
Yes.
Do you know much about that?
What
prompted it, and what does it mean for the people?
The currency devaluation is, I think, yet another attempt to control the markets. Private entrepreneurs working on the markets were amassing, you know, large amounts of currency, you know, kind of ignoring the orders from Pyongyang to, you know, restrain market activity. And I think the regime wanted to bring in that currency. You know, again, they are trying to turn back the clock. And this was not, I don't think anybody thinks this was an economic reform. This was a way of trying to get control.
Well, they must be aware that sooner or later the whole thing is going to fall apart because it's a house of cards. I guess it's as long as I'm doing okay, I'm not going to worry about that.
I think the number one goal of this regime is regime survival. You know, I don't think they want people to starve, but their primary goal is protecting themselves.
And there are many people in this country who are critical of any attempt to open up North Korea, to have contact with it. What do you think about a policy of engagement similar to what we've done with China? Would that be a good idea, or should we keep a policy similar to what we've done with Cuba in place?
Oh, I can answer this one very easily. I'd say engage, engage, engage. I think the more engagement, the better.
And will they respond to engagement? Because it seems to be one day they're encouraging some kind of a meeting, and then the next day they're shooting off a missile to discourage a meeting.
You know, they won't respond in the way we want. But I think, you know, for every North Korean who sees the outside world, who, you know, goes to a New York Philharmonic concert, who sees a foreigner in their country, you know, I think they learn something, and it brings the country into a point of normalcy. And, you know, I think one thing we have to look at with North Korea, because I believe the system will collapse at some point, is, you know, who are going to be the next generation of rulers? You know, one of the criticisms of engagement is that when you bring a North Korean delegation abroad to study, you're getting only members of the elite, you know, maybe, you know, relatives of the ruling family. But, you know, somewhere in there is the next generation of leaders. So I think the more engagement, the better. And, I mean, I'd cynically say, I shouldn't say this on the record, but I'm here, you know, the more exposure to the outside, the quicker they're going to collapse.
Barbara Demick's book, Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea, is published by Spiegel & Grau. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.